This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
About animals, farm animals, and domesticated animals today. This is part of a series on caring for creation that that we've been doing here at Libri. We only really started last term, so it's the series has just begun, and it's of an unknown length. We will probably add to it as we go. But Anna Friedrich and I have been sort of going back and forth on it a bit. In this lecture, I want to try to connect the question of what we eat with the broader responsibility of being stewards of God's creation. How are those two things related? How we eat, actually, I think is very, very much a part of creation care. And I'll just try to make that case throughout the course of the evening. But first of all, I'll just make a few comments. Farmed animals make up that part of creation that is most immediately under human control, if you think about that. Creation is a big thing. We did a couple of lectures on what is our relationship to wild animals, and that's a very, very different topic. But farmed animals are, in a unique way, under human control. Secondly, meat production is connected in some way with almost every aspect of the ecological problems we have, almost every one of them. It's not the sole cause, obviously, but it's connected to issues of pollution, issues of greenhouse gas emissions, certainly very related to deforestation. And so it's connected to much broader questions about creation care. And then thirdly, what to eat is really a matter of choice for many people in the modern West. Not everybody, so people living in poverty, what they eat is not a matter of choice. You know, if you have food, then you eat it. But for those of us who enjoy the privilege of choice when it comes to food, our eating habits are actually a wonderful place to start caring for creation. This is one way in which we can bring the very high and sometimes daunting task of stewardship within reach. Now, I say within reach, but that doesn't mean it's easy. There's a great need for humility on this whole topic of food, what we eat, how our conscience impacts those kinds of decisions, right? Because different people's consciences guide them to do very different things about that. And the tendency or the temptation is to look down on other people because their conscience doesn't affect them in the same way that my conscience affects me, right? And we really need to be careful not to do that. I feel very almost uncomfortable lecturing on this topic tonight because I'm very new to this sort of area of thinking as a topic of study. I've thought about it from afar for a while, but there's a lot that I don't know, and there's a lot of thinking that I still have to do. And I view myself as a sort of, in my family, as kind of being in this process of rethinking how we eat. And so in a sense, I feel hypocritical about even giving this talk because, and I've, I maybe should have postponed it another couple of years down the road until I actually had, made some of these changes, which I think would be good. I'm not going to hold my own life up as a practical example. I'm very aware of participating in the very problems that I'm criticizing tonight, which probably most of us are, if we're honest. So humility is called for. Just to give a brief idea of an outline for what we're going to be talking about tonight, because this is a series. I don't know why that dot is there. Okay, good mark. there. That's the assurance that this will end. This talk will end. That's the period at the end. Good. Because this is a talk about creation care, I'm going to give a little bit of a review of some of the things we've been talking about already. Some reflections on the fact that we're very conflicted over this issue. What does the Bible have to say about farm animals and eating them? And a little bit of a exposure as to what happens in the meat industry. And then some concluding remarks. So, first of all, review. I guess an important question when we talk about creation care is why care? This is maybe the most basic starting point. Why do we care about creation? Why should we care? And there's many reasons. And I am just going to mention four very, very broad, what I would call motivations for why Christian people, if we are Christians or if we're looking to the Bible and the God of the Bible as our reason for caring about anything, these are four of them. First and foremost, caring for creation is obedience. That's really the primary reason, even if all the other reasons disappeared. There's lots and lots of teaching in the Bible telling us that we're supposed to care for the world around us. From the very, very beginning in Genesis 1 and 2, and throughout, after the fall, into the New Testament. So it's a matter of obedience to God. God has told us that we're supposed to be stewards, caretakers of this world. And we are supposed to respond to that call. Secondly, it's self-preservation. Whether we recognize it or not, human beings, we are embedded in the world that we're called to care for. Human beings stand over creation, but they're also part of creation. So we are completely dependent on the health of the natural world. So to talk about earth-keeping is to talk about people-keeping. Particularly if we step back and look at sort of long-term strategies. To care for the earth well is to care for the human race well. Because whether we like it or not, we can't remove ourselves from dependence on the earth. This is where God has chosen to put us. So, I think environmental degradation due to raising animals, like I said earlier, deforestation, as well as a lot of the work that people are in the meat industry, which is quite dangerous, difficult work. These are animal issues as well as human issues. So there's all kinds of areas to explore there, maybe in our discussion. There's so many loose ends in this talk that I really am going to rely on the discussion if you have things that you want to chase down or have clarified. So thirdly, that was, it's first and foremost, it's obedience, then it's self-preservation because we are part of the very world we're supposed to be caring for. Thirdly, it is a witness. The Christian church, believe it or not, has not had a good reputation, or not solely a good reputation when it comes to creation care. There's been wonderful acceptance to that, and there are today, but there's also a history of a lot of abuse within the church. And this, I think, is a really sad irony because Christians have a unique theological foundation for caring for the world in a way that many secular environmentalists do not, actually. We have much better reasons for loving and caring for the natural world than some of our friends who do not share our faith. So this is an area that Francis Schaeffer would have called us to be co-belligerents. He coined this phrase, that we should be co-belligerents. In other words, willing to work alongside people because of our common concern for a particular issue, even though they don't share our faith at all. We may disagree about literally everything else. That's fine, but we're supposed to be alongside people where our faith aligns with their concerns as well. I think this will be a witness to the world of what concerns the living God. What kind of things does God actually care about? This will be a witness to people. Not to mention it may undo some stereotypes about what Christianity is all about. And we should always be eager to do that. And I think this will draw people to the faith. This will draw people to God. Fourthly, to care for creation is a source of wonder and joy. And that this is not necessarily in order of importance. This is a very significant thing. One of the creational purposes of animals, one of the reasons God made them, is so that they would glorify Him and point to Him. And they do under the right circumstances. So the more we understand and care for the animals God has made, the better we'll understand God, the one who made them. And this is, the Bible is full of exhortations to look at creation and learn something about God, right? Psalm 19 is a classic one, looking at the stars, looking at the things God has made. As we do that, in humility, we will learn something about the one who made it. Also, in addition to that, we are creation caretakers by design. It's one of the things, according to the Bible, that people are for. One of our purposes. So, connecting with this creational calling to care for other creatures, essentially doing what we were made to do, is, I think, one of the ways to a full and a beautiful life. A life that you could be described with the word shalom. A fullness of well-being. As we do what we're actually made to do. So, that's just a little bit of review in terms of why care about creation at all. And now we're going to shift more to speaking specifically about animals. One of the bizarre incongruities in our culture today is that animals are both elevated and denigrated. Every day, everywhere we look. We simultaneously sentimentalize animals and brutalize them. And one of the points I want to make is that these are both mistakes. It's not like one is better than the other here. What do I mean by sentimentalize? There's nothing wrong with loving or being kind to or being attached to an animal. I think of, you know, lots of people who are very, very attached and love a particular animal, maybe a pet or something like that. There's nothing wrong with feeling an affection for wild animals or whatever. That's a good thing. However, we do tend, and there's always a temptation to anthropomorphize animals, basically project human qualities onto animals, especially pets, maybe. We think of them, this is just something that I, we think of them and treat them as if they are humans, as if they are just as self-aware, self-conscious as people, as if they are just as emotionally complex as people, and as if they are just as valuable as people. Pets are people too, right? There was signs all over Vancouver when we lived in Vancouver that, you know, pets are people too, people, t-shirts, everything. Now I understand why people say this, and that's, it's very much a response to, cruel treatment of animals, right? And this is a reaction against that. No, they're people too. In other words, care for them, right? But the statement itself is just not true. They're not people. I think, so anyway, that's just where I'm going to leave that. We're also another aspect of sentimentalizing animals. We are massively preoccupied with the cuteness of certain animals and not others, right? So it's very, very selective in terms of where our affections lie. How many hours of cat videos are watched by Americans each day? Just not these on cats. I'm not trying to. Probably a lot. I don't know how many hours of cat videos are watched every day in America, but it's an endless resource online. Millions and millions, maybe billions of baby animal photographs and videos are available to us. You could spend all day fawning over the cuteness of animals. If you think of the calendars and of unlikely friends, there's little books of unlikely friends where there's pictures of animals that have nothing to do with each other that are like draped over each other. I think there's odd books in the world. Got nothing intrinsically against these pictures, you know. I was anticipating that the whole room would go, oh, because it's hard mounting, right? I think a lot of these pictures can, and some of them are even designed in order to give us a misleading sense that peace and harmony reign in the natural world, right? That there's human-like love and affection between creatures. One of the things that, maybe not across the board, but one of the observations I've made about the unlikely friends pictures is that the predators are either babies or asleep in all the pictures. Which means they might be even maybe sedated or something. So this gives us a misleading picture of what the natural world is actually like. There's no doubt that the animals in these pictures are beautiful. I totally got sucked in while preparing the slideshow, and you know, there's like 20 extra slides that I didn't show. But the main question I want to ask is how are we using these pictures as a culture, and what purpose do they serve for us? You know, why do we look at them? You know, I think there's a danger maybe that we're constructing sort of a rose-tinted picture of the animal kingdom to compensate for harsher realities that we know exist, but we don't really want to think about. And that's really how sentimentality functions. It's a way of rose-tinting reality, so we don't have to think about things we don't want to think about. And that leads us to the brutality part. I remember I talked about us sentimentalizing and brutalizing animals at the same time. That's the weird paradox. Most Americans participate not out of malice, but by the food we buy and eat, in a system of meat production that inflicts nearly unrelenting suffering on animals. And that's not an exaggeration. Some of the very same species that we fawn over online are in factory farms. And we'll talk about some of the inherent issues with large-scale industrial farming later. This is a hen shed, chicken shed. So we have sentimentality on the one hand, and brutality on the other, and why is this? What's going on? I think one of the issues that we're both elevating animals above their true status and we're denigrating them below their true status. Another way of saying that is that we are both assigning them human dignity when they're not humans, and then we're robbing them of their animal dignity, which is a real thing. So we've found a way to somehow fall off both sides of the roof at the same time. To assign human dignity to animals when they're not human, and then to rob them of their animal dignity, which is a real thing. So my point is neither is pleasing to God. We can begin to treat animals rightly, I think, when we treat them as animals, neither more nor less. That's actually the way forward in terms of treating them well, is treating them like what they actually are. The elevation and denigration of animals are actually different sides of the same coin, and this is one of the things about sentimentality. Sentimentality is never far from cruelty. It doesn't look like that. But we can tell ourselves that we love animals because we get warm feelings from pictures, and we find them cute. But ironically, this can actually function as a total wet blanket on our willingness to actually do anything about animal suffering. So sentimentality is about feeling like a humane person, right? It's not necessarily about being humane or kind or making any kind of sacrifice or taking any kind of action that would cost us anything at all. It's about feeling humane. And as long as I can feel humane, I don't really have to do anything, right? So, sentimentality is a tricky thing. It can pose as being very, very nice and harmless, but it's actually closely akin to cruelty, or at least it can be. So that's one of the ways in which we're kind of divided. Another way in which we're divided within our culture is just this issue is divisive. People disagree on this issue. How should animals be treated? Is this something that we need to make a priority? Some people are calling for change, while others view their lifestyles as non-negotiable and just get off my back. Stop trying to make me worry about things that I don't want to worry about. So, do animals have rights? That's a huge question. Should human beings make costly decisions in the interest of animal welfare? Yes, no, yes, no. You know, this is a hotly debated topic. Like everything else today, I guess, seemingly. Polarization over this issue runs right down the middle of the church, too. It's not one of these... it's just that the Christian church has been divided on this issue going way back into church history, not just today. So there's voices on both sides of the spectrum when it comes to animal care. On the one side, there are Christian people who feel that they have a God-ordained right not to care at all. I don't mean that in a, I'm not trying to poke fun at it but that is a fair description of some people I've spoken to in terms of their attitude towards it. And I don't want to caricature anybody, but, in this view, the dominion that God gives humans at creation is interpreted practically as permission to do whatever we want to animals. And it's functioned as an excuse for any cruelty or, at the very least, grounds for indifference. I don't have to worry about this because we have dominion, right? If humans, because we're in the image of God, have a divinely signed carte blanche, blank check, then treatment of animals cannot really be a moral issue. That's how the reasoning goes. If my status as a human being, as the image bearer of God, and a person with dominion gives me this right not to care, then it's not a moral issue what we do with an animal. So within this way of thinking, animals have usually been viewed as only having value insofar as they're useful to people. So it's an instrumental value, essentially. Only valuable if they're useful to a person. Interestingly, Thomas Aquinas held something like this view. And his teaching in his Summa Theologica has influenced the Roman Catholic Church's views on all kinds of things ever since. He himself, I think, and I haven't read Thomas Aquinas in any depth, really, but he, I think, is more influenced by Aristotle than he is by the Bible when it comes to animals, and some other things, too, but on when it comes to his view of animals. And I'll just read a couple quotes from a couple different parts of the Summa Theologica, which is a massive big work. According to the divine ordinance, the life of animals and plants is preserved not for themselves, but for man. Hence, as Augustine says, by a most just ordinance of the Creator, both their life and their death are subject to our use. And then again, these are three different passages, I think. Dumb animals and plants are devoid of the life of reason, whereby to set themselves in motion. They are moved, as it were, by another, by a kind of natural impulse, a sign of which is that they are naturally enslaved and accommodated to the uses of others. So that's getting at this issue of animals are not rational the way human beings are, therefore, and they're not self-consciously making decisions and choices the way human beings can. So therefore, their lives are sort of subject to the desires of human beings who have that ability. Right? And then lastly, he says, he that kills another's ox sins not through killing the ox, but through injuring another man in his property. So, granted, these are taken out of context, but these quotes do sum up, I think, his view on the human relationship to animals. Right? Animals are useful because they're useful to people. are valuable because they're useful to people. So it's actually not a long logical step from this view to the view that dominion actually requires cruelty. And that's been an attitude too that's run through the church, that in order to exercise dominion, we actually have to behave cruelly. We have to assert our dominion in ways, in a sense, to almost prove it or establish it. At various times and places, the humane treatment of animals has actually been viewed as a failure to live out God's calling on us. That's sort of a little bit more of a vicious approach. But I think in my experience, by far the most common response today from Christians when it comes to the conversation about animal welfare is that we should be worrying about people. Let's not get preoccupied with the suffering of animals when there are people suffering who are of greater value to God. There's people suffering everywhere, where there's people that need to hear about Jesus. There's all these other priorities that just outweigh this concern about animals. I've heard that many, many times in conversations with people. And this, I think, on some level is a compelling thought. Jesus did tell his disciples that they were worth more than many sparrows. We don't want to shrink away from this idea that God actually values human beings incredibly highly, right? Above that of animals. That's the truth. And sometimes I think choices have to be made between animals and people. There's scenarios you can imagine in which a government has to allocate funds, limited resources in some way, and there has to be a decision there. Okay, well, what's more valuable, right? What's the priority? But overall, I think this attitude can be an oversimplification and just a way of dismissing concern for animals. It doesn't always come from people who have actually a great concern for people either. Sometimes it does. Often at the root of this objection, I think there's an assumption that there's a dignity seesaw. This is the image in my head. There's this dignity, that there's only so much dignity to go around, right? And if we get too uppity about animal dignity and worth, that goes up, and by necessity, our concern for human dignity goes down, right? As if it's a zero-sum game. If you care too much about animals, you're just by definition, you're not going to be caring enough about people. You can think of it as a tug of war, maybe, where, you know, if one side's winning, the other side's losing. By definition, that's what a tug of war is. And I don't think we need to make a choice like this between the things that God cares about. In addition, I don't think there's one kind of dignity. There's dignities. There's different kinds of dignity. There's human dignity. There's animal dignity. And they're not on opposite ends of a seesaw. Both human welfare and animal welfare are morally significant issues for Christians today. And we really shouldn't pit animals and humans against each other unless it's absolutely necessary, unless we have to. And we very often don't have to. Particularly if we step back and think in the broad picture, the long-term decisions that we make in society, the welfare of animals and the welfare of human beings are very much tied together, actually. Like I was saying in the beginning, we are, by God's design, embedded in this creation. And to abuse it around us is essentially self-destructive. Even though in the short term it may seem like caring for people more than animals, right? But actually it can end up being self-destructive in many ways. And there's a million things to say there, and I'm sure people could take issue with that, but I'm going to move on. Okay, so that's sort of on the what I would consider the negative side. On the other side, we're talking about the church and the way that the church itself has been divided over the years. So on the other side of this whole issue, from very early on in the church, there have been Christians who have had a very different view of animals. Most famously, probably, St. Francis of Assisi, very well known for his love and concern for animals, his poems and hymns mentioning them, referring to them as his essentially his brothers. He's aware of this sort of kinship that he has to other living creatures, both made by God, equally dependent on God in every moment, receivers of gifts from God. He had a sense of kinship. But even going further back, there is a prayer that's attributed to St. Basil of Caesarea. There's a lot of chatter online that says it's a hoax and it's not really from him. I have no idea. It's certainly very old. but it might not be Basil of Caesarea. But anyway, even if it isn't, let's read it. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. O God, enlarge within us the sense of fellowship with all living things. Our brethren, the animals, to whom thou gavest the earth as their home, in common with us. We remember with shame that in the past we have exercised the high dominion of man with ruthless cruelty, so that the voice of the earth, which should have gone up to thee in song, has been a groan of travail. May we realize that they live not for us alone, but for themselves and for thee, and that they love the sweetness of life even as we, and serve thee in their place better than we in ours. There's a lot in that, obviously. But he seems to have a sense of a commonality, a kinship between people and animals. The fact that we're given the earth in common, we're sharing this place, whether we like it or not. He has a sense that dominion is a high and a good thing. There was this capacity that human beings have to rule in the world, and yet it's been abused and become domination. And then he also has a sense of what we would call, what people in the whole field of animal ethics would call sentience. A sentient being is a creature that can experience pain and experience pleasure and everything. He has a sense that animals actually enjoy the sweetness of life. You know, they're not just a rock. You know, they actually not only have senses but have some sort of consciousness of enjoyment through their senses. So this is not a universal call to vegetarianism or anything like that. But it is a very, very biblically, theologically grounded sort of argument for just treatment of other living things. It's not really an argument. It's a prayer. So later on, as many, many people actually within the Reform tradition that had things to say about this, about animal treatment, I want to refer you, before I forget, to a lecture that's available online on the Libri Ideas Library. If you go to Libri Ideas Library, you'll find a lecture by a guy named Philip Sampson. He gave a lecture at the English Libri a while back, and he's a specialist in like what the Reformers said about animal welfare. Really interesting. Quite focused level of research, but he knows a lot about it, and it's very, very interesting. So it's kind of encouraging, actually, to hear that there's been lots of voices in the church who have not just been, rubber stamping cruelty to animals, right? Anyway, Philip Sampson, check it out. For that reason, I'm not going to go into any of that stuff because he does a much better job at it, and I'll just direct you towards him. People who are associated with their concern for social justice in the history, in English history, William Wilberforce, Lord Shaftesbury, various other people were also very concerned about the treatment of animals. So I believe William Wilberforce was involved in starting the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in England. So this is part of his many, many concerns. You know, he's this politician of some repute, he's powerful, and he's a Bible-believing Christian, and he's trying to decide what are the issues I should be fighting for. One of them was slavery, and another one was animal welfare. Interesting. Anyway. Today, correct. Yes, that's what I meant. Thank you. For the record, William Wilberforce fought against slavery, not for it. thank you, Richard. Today, there's a lot of very, very thoughtful Christians making arguments for why believers should be vegetarians. This is an interesting thing. There's a lot of literature, way more than I could read for this lecture. Not just as a protest against cruelty, but as a way of actively living into this vision of the kingdom of God as being one that is peaceable Now, I don't think I agree with everything that some of these people have written, but it's very, they've thought about it more than many other Christians. Another resource is the organization called SARCS, S-A-R-X. It's the Greek word for flesh. And that's an organization that's done a lot of work on animal welfare. Lots of articles to read online coming from their website. Some on the more radical side, there's many Christians who would say, maybe not many, but quite a few Christians who would say, all believers in the God of the Bible have a clear moral responsibility to be vegan. It's just like, it's the vegan meaning to avoid all animal products. That means not just food, but any animal product in clothing or other products that use animals. To be a very, very strict vegan is actually very, very difficult, given how many products have something to do with animals in them. But in any case, some people would argue this. There's a documentary maker named Chris Delforce, Australian guy, who's made a number of movies dealing with he's kind of an undercover expose documentary maker for intensive factory farms, and he goes into these places and hides cameras and a lot of the most disturbing and horrible footage that we have today is the result of his documentaries. The most recent one is called Dominion. His first was called Earthlings. There's another one called Lucent. They're all dealing with what goes on behind closed doors in factory farms. He says, this is Chris Delforce, veganism is the moral baseline, basically the lowest ethical bar for Christians. In other words, start by becoming vegan and then see what else you can do. I've watched some interviews that he's done, and he said, we can start eating animals as soon as animals don't mind being killed. Anyway. And if you watch any of his films, it is just painfully clear that an animal is fighting for its life. You know, there's a definite desire to live. I think lots of people who are not Christians but are concerned for animal rights often point to the doctrine of the image of God, and particularly the belief in human dominion, as really the root of the problem. Like, this is where it all starts, in terms of abusing the environment in general. And cruelty to animals. Basically, we think we're so great. We think we have this big thumbs up from God that we can do whatever we want, and the Bible teaches that, and that's why we have the mess we do today. I will say that I think that has been the interpretation of those doctrines by various people at various times. So it's not totally without cause, that attitude. But it's not a correct interpretation, I wouldn't say, of what dominion and the image of God actually mean. But given that that is the attitude, there are Christian folks who are involved in animal rights issues who sort of shy away from the doctrine of the Imago Dei. They wouldn't necessarily deny it, but they don't talk about it much because of this association that this is the root of the problem. It's just we think we're above the rest of creation, right? And so there's a discomfort with this idea that humans actually really do have a special value before God above animals. And to downplay this and to shy away from the image of God is a big mistake, I think. I think it's much better to lean into it and try to understand what it really means in terms of our responsibility to animals. So, despite all this debate, there's different voices going, the fact remains that most people in this country are oblivious to the whole conversation and are not particularly interested in thinking about where their food comes from. That's the vast majority of people, right? I've been talking about the people that actually think about this, right? Most people are pretty content to just keep on living the way they live without really much reflection. Okay, moving on to this whole idea of biblical vegetarianism, or what does the Bible actually say? I'm not really talking about biblical vegetarianism. I'm talking a much broader in a much broader terms about what the Bible says about animals, and raising animals for food particularly. I want to look at biblical teaching in two very loose, broad categories that have been helpful to me in terms of thinking about different kinds of teaching. The first category is very general ethical teaching about how animals should be treated when they're alive, ranging from general principles in creation to specific laws in the Old Testament to some of the things implied in Jesus' words. So this is very broad in scope, but it basically has to do with how we're supposed to treat a living animal. Second category is specifically about eating animals. In other words, what kinds of situations justify the killing of an animal? So, in a sense, you could think of it as the ethics of animal life and the ethics of animal death in the Bible. And I want to deal with the first one. First, general teaching on how we treat living animals. And I believe that the Bible teaches that animals have inherent value. There's a philosopher named Terence Cuneo that one of our students, John, has turned me on to. Terence Cuneo calls this non-instrumental worth. He's a philosopher and he has very fine-tuned ways of saying things. But he's animals have non-instrumental worth. In other words, they have value in themselves independently of their usefulness to people. So this is, he would disagree with Aquinas here very strongly. How does he conclude this? Many people have concluded this. It's not just Terence Cuneo. But in Genesis 1, it's really interesting. In Genesis 1, God declares animals good before people are created. This is the, day 5. He's made birds and sea creatures. And that day ends. And it's very good. It's good. Not very good yet. Before human beings are even there to put animals to any use in particular, right? So it's clear that it's a funny sort of detail, but it's clear that the animals that God has made are a delight to him by being themselves. For being themselves. They're being what he made them to be, and it brings him delight. He says it's good. Not because they were of particular service to people. Animals receive, on that same day, receive blessing, the blessing to be fruitful and multiply, which is a parallel to God's blessing on humans, which comes a little bit later. It's not an identical blessing, but it's obviously a very parallel blessing. God shows his desire for the flourishing of animals on the earth. He gives them food, he tells them to go and to reproduce and fill the earth and be fruitful. So if this is true, then it sets in context God's blessing to human beings. I think it's almost like it has some parameters, particularly when it comes to the command to rule and subdue the earth. Right? Go. This is what God says to human beings: go, you know, be fruitful and multiply, rule over and subdue all the creatures. That command, which is really a blessing, should in no way undermine his earlier blessing to the animals. God isn't handing out mutually exclusive blessings or blessings that have to be fought over in this pre-fallen good world that he's made. The two blessings are not pitted against each other at all. If anything, rule and subdue has more to do with exercising our power, our very real power in the world to bring further order and to allow greater thriving and flourishing of all living things, including ourselves. Genesis 2, I'm not going to go into it in any detail right now, but Genesis 2 has this interesting other perspective on the creation of people. There's two different stories, and we're supposed to hold them together. And the language used there, instead of ruling and subduing, which is very much almost a military kind of, you know, bringing order to a unruly population or something like that. The language in Genesis 2 is language that's used of a priest in the temple, tending to the temple. Those are these sort of balancing images. We're supposed to rule and tend to the temple, which means care for it, love it. But also, creation is a little chaotic, and we're supposed to exercise our power in it. Anyway. Implication here, I think, is that we are not permitted, even in a post-fallen world, even in a very broken world, the one we find ourselves in, We're not permitted to view animals as existing solely for their usefulness to us. They are more than a means to human ends. The book of Job is a wonderful demonstration of this, as well as many other things. But Job, when God finally comes and speaks to Job, it's a barrage of questions he's asking Job, and it has almost entirely to do with creation, mostly questions that Job could not possibly answer. And it becomes clear as you read this. Obviously, it's meant to bring a new perspective to Job and to help him grow in humility, and he's just remind him that he's a person and not God. But one of the things you kind of learn about God here is that he's delighting in all these wild animals that have nothing to do with human welfare at all. Job doesn't even probably know what some of these animals are, but they bring delight to God, not because they're useful to Job, but just because. So, another aspect of this whole issue is dignity. We've already talked about it a little bit, but by dignity I mean on some level worthy of respect, deserving of respect. So animals are due a level of respect as creatures made by and loved by God. It follows then, I think, if we allow for dignity, for animal dignity to be a real thing, it follows that it is possible to wrong an animal, to treat it with less than the appropriate respect that God has in mind for it. An animal can be treated in a way that does not reflect its actual dignity before God. Terrible example, but to kick a rock down the road does not violate the dignity of that rock, I don't think. But if you did the same thing to a chicken, it does violate the dignity of that chicken. The fact that it's a living thing whose life is given and sustained by God gives it greater dignity, and as a result, a higher ethical standard applies to it. So, according to God, there are actually ethical limits on what a person can do to an animal. Animal dignity is closely related to the notion of animal rights, and this is a very debated issue, right? Animal rights. Lots of people disagree strongly and loudly about this. I'm not really sure. I mean, part of the whole conversation is about semantics and what you mean when you say right. And so I want to just kind of back off and not get too militant about anything. But to me, there's a way in which we can understand animal rights that doesn't place animals on the same level with people, because I don't think they have the same rights as people. It doesn't mean that they don't have rights. the language of rights does take seriously the fact that the God-given dignity of animals is likely to be violated unless it's actively protected. Mm-hmm. Right? If we talk about rights, that means we're at least aware of this possibility that their dignity is going to get stomped on unless it's protected. And the word rights implies or communicates a sense of obligation more strongly than most other language. A lot of people prefer to use the term animal welfare rather than animal rights. And I have no problem with that. I think that's great. But as long as you actually mean it, right? Andrew Lindsay, really interesting guy. He's probably the person who has written the most, from a Christian perspective, on caring for animals. This is great, like, Hobbit-like picture. He looks like he belongs in Middle Earth. It's almost a little too idyllic. But anyway, I like it. Andrew Lindsay, he's written a lot about Christian concern, biblical concern for animals. And he feels very strongly about that we need to use the words rights. I'll read the quote in the middle in a second. For the very reason that it's the only way you're going to get anything done. It's a strategic language, because if you don't use the word rights, nobody's going to feel obligated to do anything at all about cruelty to animals, right? Anyway, so Andrew Lindsay, author of numerous books, he's a theology professor at Oxford, as well as a director of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics, and one of the earliest Christians to talk about animal rights as an important thing, back in the 1970s. he defends his view about animal rights really by inventing this new term, or I guess it's a new term called theos rights, meaning God's rights. Right? And he says this: to grant animal rights is to accept that they can be wronged. According to theos rights, what we do to animals is not simply a matter of taste or convenience or philanthropy. When we speak of animal rights, we conceptualize what is objectively owed to animals as a matter of justice by virtue of their creator's right. Animals can be wronged because their creator can be wronged in his creation. At the heart of the theological conception of rights, as we have defended it, is not a self-awarding system of obligation, but a recognition that the creator has rights to have his creation treated with respect. In other words, the entire notion of human rights and animal rights is totally dependent on God's right to be obeyed. Right? God has a right to be obeyed in his creation. If God says, treat humans and animals with dignity that befits each one of them, we have to acknowledge that humans and animals have a right, however derivative, it's a derivative right from God's right, but we have a right to be treated with dignity, first and foremost because God has a right to be respected and obeyed. So any talk of rights derives from God's right as the creator. And I find this very helpful, particularly as a perspective, as it comes into a... it helps transcend some of the bickering and arguments over animal rights versus human rights. You know, it's really not about either. It's about God's right to have the things he values respected. So, this dignity of animals that God establishes at creation, I think, is reiterated in all kinds of ways throughout the rest of the Bible. I'm just going to this is going to be like a rapid fire, just so that we're aware that it's not just in Genesis. There's lots and lots of ethical teaching on animals throughout. So in Exodus 20, verse 8, this is the Ten Commandments. Animals are included in God's Sabbath rest. Not just in the sense that, you know, give them a break from their work. They'll work harder the next day or whatever. There's nothing implied about that. They're included with animals and foreigners in the nation of Israel as receiving the blessing of Sabbath, along with the people of God. The fourth commandment, it says, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. And on it goes. But it's not just a coincidence that animals are included in this blessing of Sabbath. It's fascinating. In Deuteronomy 25:4, there's an interesting little verse completely on its own, sandwiched between instructions about punishing lawbreakers and instructions about what to do if your brother dies and leaves his widow. There is a verse that says, do not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. It's actually picked up by New Testament writers talking about how the laborer in the vineyard deserves pay for his work. Basically, you know, if you're an evangelist, if you're a minister traveling around and speaking to the churches, you know, the church should provide for you, you know. So we're, you know, people in ministry are compared to the ox tramping out the grain who should be allowed to eat something while they're working, right? Even while the ox is tramping out the grain for you, you should have its needs in mind as well as your own. You should allow the animal to partake of the fruit of its own labor, essentially, as it's working. So clearly, maximizing gains and minimizing losses should not be the only priority for the people of God. There's other priorities at play, too. Being told that I have to let the ox eat some of what would otherwise be all mine curbs my greed and obsession with efficiency and all kinds of other things. Moving along, Jonah 4, verses 10 and 11. These are the last two verses of the book of Jonah. God is responding to Jonah's callousness toward the potential destruction of Nineveh. He's not just callous, he's disappointed that God isn't destroying Nineveh, because that's what he said would happen, and he feels like he's been showed up. God says to Jonah this: "You have been concerned about this plant." He's talking about the plant that grew up one day and gave him shade, and then it died the next day, and Jonah is angry at God. "You've been concerned about this plant, but you did not tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and died overnight. And should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also many animals?" That's the end of the book of Jonah. Fascinating. Like, God did not have to say that at the end of the book of Jonah. It would have made a fine ending. Right? But it's just like, and the animals too. Striking. God's main point is that Jonah cares more about his shade plant than he does about all the people in this huge city. But why does God bother mentioning all the animals? I think because the wanton destruction of animals is a terrible possibility to God. Presumably Jonah has even less concern for the animals than he does for the Gentile humans in the city. So Jonah's not really thinking about that. The animals are below his moral notice, but they're not below God's moral notice. And obviously God is, you know, primarily concerned with the people that don't know their left hand from their right, but he also mentions the animals. Proverbs 12:10 says, "Whoever is righteous has regard for the life of his beast, but the mercy of the wicked is cruel." So I'm not really going to go into that very much, but it, according to the wisdom literature of the Bible, cruelty to an animal is a sign of moral and spiritual weakness. This is kind of what he's getting at. I'll just mention in very quickly two passages in the Gospels where Jesus is talking about the great value that God places on his people. But to make his point, he takes as a given the fact that God cares very much about animals. So Jesus isn't talking about animals directly, but he's using God's care for animals to convince his people that God really, really cares for them, right? So it's kind of what's implied by what he's saying more than the actual thrust of his teaching. He's trying to teach his disciples not to be worried. And this is in Luke 12. He says, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." This is beautiful. He's trying to convince his disciples not to be afraid because God values you. He knows everything about you. He has every hair in your head numbered. Look, he even knows everything about the sparrows. There's no such thing as an anonymous sparrow to him. There's no such thing as a generic sparrow to God. He knows them all. If one dies, he knows about it. So don't worry. You know, how much more does he care for you? So it's a rhetorical teaching device, but Jesus wouldn't even say that if he didn't know that God really loves the sparrows, right? It wouldn't make sense as a teaching device if that wasn't his assumption. Similar teaching technique in Luke 13, verses 15 through 16. The Lord answered him, this is Jesus talking to I think a Pharisee, "You hypocrites! Doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie your ox or donkey from the stall and lead it out to give it water? Then should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has kept bound for 18 long years, be set free on the Sabbath day from what bound her?" So he's talking about healing on the Sabbath. He's just been criticized for healing someone on the Sabbath because that's work. And he lights into the legalism of the Pharisees. Interestingly, he's not criticizing them for untying their donkey and bringing them to water on the Sabbath. That's not his point. He is pointing to an inconsistency, but the way to resolve that inconsistency isn't to leave your donkey tied up and not water it. He assumes that they're going to do that to alleviate the suffering of this animal. It's a desert climate. You know, if you don't water your animal, it's probably going to die or suffer greatly. Of course you're going to do that to your animal on the Sabbath, right? The inconsistency can be resolved not by leaving your donkey tied up, but allow this woman to be healed. She's a person, right? She's a child of Abraham. And so, again, it's similar to the other passage. He's really talking about the significance of people, But in order to communicate that, he talks about the significance of animals. So, let's see. That's just sort of a smattering of biblical teaching on how we should treat animals, how we should treat living animals. The second category that we're talking about is the ethics of animal death, or eating animals. What does the Bible have to say about that specifically? And that's a very different issue, but it follows logically. I mean, to talk about dignity is all well and good, but where does the line fall exactly? Where's the ethical line fall? Does God view killing animals as necessarily a violation of their dignity? Is there any such thing as humanely slaughtering an animal? Many people today would say, if you kill an animal, that is cruelty to animals. Period. You know. Anyway, what does the Bible have to say? Very core text that is important to look at is Genesis 9. Sorry, it's not too bad. Semi-small. This is after the flood. And it's the story of God making a covenant with Noah after the flood. So the ark has landed, and Noah is sort of... God is reestablishing this relationship between God and people. In some ways, reiterating some of the things that he said in creation, but now in this very broken context. So I'll just read it. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth." That should ring a bell. "The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground and on all the fish in the sea. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being, too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind." So things are very broken now, but the image of God is still real, right? Hasn't been utterly destroyed. "As for you," he says, "be fruitful and increase in number, and multiply on the earth and increase upon it." Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth." And it goes on. Anyway, that's the sort of basic passage. And there's no way I'm going to say everything that needs to be said about Genesis 9, but I'll offer a couple of observations that have to do with our topic tonight. First of all, God blesses Noah and his sons with a repeat of Genesis 1, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth." He does not repeat the command to rule and subdue. Interestingly, he leaves that out. There is a new and tension-filled dynamic between animals and people. It's as if God is really fleshing out some of the results of Genesis 3 of the fall. This is some of the ways in which it will look in the world. The harmonious relationship from Genesis 1 has become a relationship of domination on the one hand and fear on the other. Animals are going to fear human beings, and human beings have this sort of increased dominant presence. One scholar has referred to it as, it's really language of an occupying army and a conquered people. And the reason he claims this is that very, very similar language is used elsewhere in the Old Testament to refer to an army conquering a people. They will have a dread and fear of you, and God will deliver them into your hands. So I believe in Deuteronomy there's a passage that says this precisely, and it's very much the kind of language that we see in Genesis 9. Okay, second observation is really a question. Is this the moment when God allows humans to become omnivores? This is one of the pertinent questions that people bring to this. Have human beings been vegetarians up until this point? And then he gives permission to eat animals. Some people think so. Andrew Lindsay, who I respect a lot, argues this. Clearly, people had a vegetarian diet up to this point until God gives them the permission to eat animals, and then from that point on, it's different. The Old Testament scholar Ian Proven, who is a professor at Regent, some of us had classes with him, he wrote a very, very interesting book called Seriously Dangerous Religion, what the Old Testament really says and why it matters. Well worth reading, a lot of interesting essays dealing with particular topics. Anyway, Ian Proven disagrees with this entirely, and he says, the killing of animals was clearly, this is not a quote, but this is his argument, clearly already a part of religious practice. Before Genesis 9, Abel's sacrifice of a lamb to God is favored over Cain, bringing some sort of plants to God. In addition, Noah is commanded to bring both clean and unclean animals on board the ark. And he's commanded to bring a certain number of clean animals onto the ark. The implication being he needs animals, enough animals to make sacrifices, but then also have enough left to release into the world when the ark lands, right? And so the point is, in the ancient world, and Ian Proven makes this point, animal sacrifices almost always go along with the eating of the animals. You don't just burn the whole animal. There's some aspect of the ritual which involves you eating the animal in the presence of God. And you see this all the way into the, you know, this whole sacrificial system in the temple. So if animals, say lambs are being offered and goats are being offered in the context of religious practice, they were being eaten as well. Ian Proven makes another really interesting point. Genesis 1 refers to God's creation of different kinds of animals, and there's these three different Hebrew words. One of the Hebrew words used is benema. Let's see here. Which generally means livestock. It's usually translated livestock or domesticated animals. But it also refers to wild animals. There's these two other terms that seem to be referring to wild animals. In Genesis 9, however, in what's a clear allusion to Genesis 1, it's sort of a repeat of Genesis 1, the word benhama, which means livestock, isn't there. God gives Noah's family permission to eat creatures that live and move about, in verse 3. But in this case, the word is a different word. It's remes. It's not benhama. Remes always refers to wild animals of some kind. So no permission is given to eat livestock in Genesis 9. Why? Ian Proven says, it's because they were already eating it. They were already eating livestock. This is part of the practice of people at the time already. There's no reason why God would have given them permission. The only new permission granted in Genesis 9, says Ian Proven, is to hunt wild animals for food. It's quite an interesting argument, and I think quite compelling in some ways. I find it unconvincing that people were only vegetarians until Genesis 9. Third point, in verse 4, there's this strange restriction. You must not eat meat that has its lifeblood in it. Similar commands in the law later on where you have to drain the blood out of an animal before you eat it. In the ancient world, blood was thought to be synonymous with life. The blood of an animal is the life of the animal. It's somehow the life force of the animal. So for an animal to still have its lifeblood in it simply means it's still alive. So the command is actually not as weird as it sounds. The command is fairly straightforward. Maybe it is weird. Wait until an animal is really dead before you start eating it. And it's kind of a chilling thing that, you know, the fact that God has to tell people this is an indication of maybe the wickedness of pre-flood society, right? People had sunk very low. If part of the violence that's described in the chapters before the flood is this kind of thing. So, fourth point. In Genesis 9, God makes a covenant with Noah and amazingly with all living things. So the writer of Genesis does not want us to miss this, because you don't see it in this excerpt because it goes on for another many more verses, but in the space of 9 verses, he mentions the fact that God is making a covenant with all living things on earth. He mentions it 4 times, over and over and over again. It's with everything. It's not just with people. So, whatever the fallenness of the situation between animals and human beings now, despite that conflict, God includes animals and people together in this covenant. So, we, in a sense, we share a covenant with the animals. We don't have it to ourselves. God is making this covenant in common with everything that's alive on the earth. I mean, I think there's a number of things we can conclude from this. Despite the fact that humans were eating animals, this shared covenant shows that the welfare of non-human creatures should still be a moral and spiritual issue. Genesis 9 is different than Genesis 1. Things are broken, but human beings are still not let off the hook in terms of having to care for animals. What about the rest of the Bible? There's a whole lot. I mean, I think very little is said about Jesus' eating habits, but I think we can pretty much assume that he ate meat as, at the very least, as part of religious practice, the Passover meal, and sharing the Passover lamb. He certainly prepares and eats fish with his disciples at the end of John's Gospel, presumably because he was hungry and he liked fish, but also he wanted to show his disciples that he was really there. That's another passage as well, but he's eating fish. Peter's dream in Acts 10, where this sheet is lowered from heaven containing all kinds of four-footed animals as well as reptiles and birds. And God tells Peter to kill and eat in the dream, and Peter says, "No way, I've never eaten anything unclean in my life," referring to the Jewish laws. And God says, "Do not call anything impure that God has made clean." The main point, I think, of the vision is to convince Peter that he can associate with Gentiles and that he should not shrink from sharing the gospel with Gentiles, because when he wakes up, it's when the people are knocking on his door and trying to convince him to come and speak to Cornelius, who's a Roman. And so this God is convincing him, you know, you need to change your attitude towards Gentiles. But I think secondary meaning is that a lot of the spiritual cleanliness laws that restrict what Jews could eat don't really apply under this new covenant. So God is addressing distinctions between different animals, but for our purposes in this topic, it's notable that there are animals at all in the sheet, right? it's clear that a faithful Jewish convert to Christianity could eat meat. Otherwise, God would not have revealed this to Peter. Anyway, hold on to all these thoughts, and we're just going to move on to a much more contemporary I'm afraid, more disturbing topic, which is how do we actually get meat today? So I've laid out some of the biblical teaching on animals, and I'm going to talk a little bit now about factory farming, and then at the end, hopefully, offer some thoughts about how to move forward. This is the only quote from one of the Beatles that I'm going to include tonight, from Sir Paul McCartney. He said, "If slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be vegetarian." I don't actually think this is true. I bet lots of people wouldn't be vegetarian. It takes a lot for people to alter the way they like to live. Although I think maybe many, many more people would think very hard about what they eat. If this was not, I mean, what he's referring to is the secrecy of factory farming. I mean, like, most of the footage and photographs we have of what really happens in big, intensive factory farms was taken illegally, or taken by people who have snuck in and unbeknownst to the factory owners have taken pictures. So it's not something that the meat industry is broadcasting. There's some disturbing content here. I've actually, believe it or not, showed great restraint in what I decided to talk about and show. I'm not going to show lots of nasty pictures or anything, but I think it's important to have at least a general idea of where chicken, beef, and pork come from if we're going to claim to have really considered this issue at all. We need to know at least a little bit about what happens in order for us to have meat on the table. We live in a time in which meat is available at a lower price and in greater quantities than the world has ever known. This is a fact. The regularity with which most people in the modern West expect to eat meat is unique historically. There's no equivalent to it in the Bible in terms of the expectation to have meat every day. that's not really the something that would have made sense to someone in the time of say the Exodus or even first century Rome or Palestine. Meat was eaten in extreme moderation compared to today. But today, for this amount of meat to be affordable, it really necessitates this massive industrial system of intensive factory farms. That's the it's the demand which makes this necessary. Statistics are very, very hard to pin down when you try to find accurate statistics about how many animals are slaughtered each year. You go to different websites and you see very different things. Approximately 9 billion chickens are killed each year for their meat. It's 24 million a day, evidently. Roughly 305 million laying hens are laying eggs today. Approximately 29 million cows are slaughtered each year in this country. This is all America. And 121 million pigs each year. One horrifying statistic from 2006, and I don't have no reason to doubt it, but 10 million pigs died during transport from the farm to the slaughterhouse over the course of a whole year. Another thing I need to say is that everything that I'm saying right now is not like me talking about the worst case scenario, like this happened once in a factory. This is standard. What I'm saying is very, very widespread and standard practice in factory farms. There's a lot written about the cruelty of this whole system and a lot of films that have been made about it, exposing it. One of the guys, Chris Delforce, that I mentioned earlier, has done the most. And again, I'll try to address the topic in two categories, similar to the way we approach the Bible. Two categories, what is an animal's life like and what is an animal's death like? We're talking about animal life and animal death. There's ethical principles that sort of we're thinking about in both cases. What are the ethics of animal life and the ethics of animal death when it comes to factory farms? First of all, life. I'm not going to systematically do that. I'm just going to pick a couple of topics and then give you examples because there's no way to cover it fully. Genetic modification and use of hormones. This is a standard procedure in most factory farms. What we call broiler chickens, the smaller chickens that you buy and as whole birds, they are bred and treated with hormones to grow unnaturally fast. Again, this is about efficiency and producing a huge quantity of meat quickly. So broilers are killed between 7 and 9 weeks of age, and that's they're already 4 pounds. I've raised chickens before myself, and they do. When they are 7 or 9 weeks of age, they're still tiny, right? The birds that are being raised in these factory farms are both genetically engineered and fed hormones so that they grow way, 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 way faster than they should be growing naturally. This is an incredibly short time to be 4 pounds, 7 weeks for a bird. Because of this accelerated growth, birds have a very, very unnatural muscle-to-bone ratio. So their muscles are growing way faster than their bones are developing. They gain muscle mass so quickly that their bones can hardly support their own weight. So it's very, very common in factory farms for chickens' legs to just break. And then they basically die in their own waste, unable to move. Similarly, birds' organs cannot support their own muscle mass either. If you think of, you know, your lungs have to absorb a certain amount of oxygen for your muscles to even work, right? But the muscle mass is so out of proportion with the organ capacity of chickens that they suffer from all kinds of health issues, respiratory problems, very often dying of respiratory problems even before the 7 to 9 week age. On egg farms, this is a different issue. Again, we're sort of talking about genetic engineering. But through genetic engineering, male chicks emerge from their eggs a different color than females. Usually it's actually quite difficult to tell the sex of a baby chicken right after they hatch. People who really know what they're doing can do it, but it's quite difficult until they get older. Scientists have figured out a way to modify chickens genetically so that male chicks are a different color. Are darker. This means that they can be immediately after hatching, they can be separated from the female chicks, either thrown in the garbage and slowly crushed under more chicks, or shuttled onto a separate conveyor belt that literally dumps them alive into a macerator, which is basically a blender. So because they will never be able to lay eggs. Approximately, I think, 260 million male chicks are killed on egg farms as a byproduct or waste product of egg production. They're referred to as a byproduct of egg production. Another very, very common practice is flesh trimming without anesthetics. Most male pigs and bulls and rams are castrated without any painkillers because reproduction is so carefully controlled on a factory farm. It's all through artificial insemination, so castration without any kind of anesthetic is commonplace. Pigs' tails are cut off to prevent tail biting, other pigs biting their tails, and chickens are almost always de-beaked, so you know the majority of their beak cut off to prevent them from attacking and injuring other birds within the hen house. Cow's horns are cut off, sometimes burned down to the stub for the same reason. Now, all of these examples of flesh trimming, it's kind of a euphemism, are to keep animals from injuring each other. And the reason why that's such a concern on factory farms is that they're, without exception, they're kept in such close quarters with each other that they will do that. Animals don't behave that way if they have enough space. But if you cram a bunch of animals together into a tiny space, they attack each other. We probably would do the same thing. So, let's look at a couple slides. So this is a large chicken shed, hundreds of thousands of birds in one place, hardly room to move at all. Chickens are kept either, and this is actually an improvement over the way some chickens are kept in cages. A lot of laying chickens are kept in cages with multiple other birds. In this kind of concentration of chickens, it's completely unnatural to how a chicken behaves socially. There's no discernible pecking order possible when you have this many birds. You know, chickens are actually quite social animals. They establish a pecking order in a flock of birds, and everybody kind of knows who's boss, and everybody knows how to get along, and nobody fights as long as they have enough space. But that only works with a flock of birds that's like at tops 50. But you throw a couple thousand birds into a hen house like this, they have no idea what to do, and it's chaos. They do end up attacking each other. They're frantic, stressed, and aggressive to each other. That's one of the reasons why once a bird gets injured for whatever reason or sick, very often they're just pecked to pieces. So, chaos. Essentially from not respecting what a chicken is, right? And how God has made a chicken to be. I think pig farms are probably the worst. On a pig farm, sows are artificially inseminated and then moved into what's called gestation crates, where they're unable to even turn around for their whole pregnancy. This is a fairly sterile, nice picture of gestation crates, actually compared to many, but you get the idea. You can't imagine any one of those animals turning. and you know, just standing in their own waste for a long, long time. These are gestation crates. All of these are pregnant sows. They're moved into what's called farrowing crates, which are where they have their piglets and where their piglets nurse. These are even more restricted. That's a farrowing crate. There's no piglets in that picture, but the piglets would be on the side over here. And there's another one. That's what a farrowing crate is. That's how it's designed, so that the sow lays on its side and the babies can eat. Unbelievably restricted and filthy, and very often a huge number of piglets are crushed by their mothers because their mothers just can't move properly. And because of these conditions, there's all kinds of health issues, infections, horrible things that happen. And so, what does the industry do? Pumps them full of antibiotics, right? So rather than address the problem of overcrowding as a problem, no, don't do anything about that. Just layer another technology on top of it and pretend that it fixes the problem. So most meat that we get today, unless it specifically says otherwise, is pumped full of antibiotics to prevent the animals from dying of infections and diseases from spreading in close quarters. One of the issues that I'm not going to talk about much at all tonight is that cows, by and large, are fed corn, which fattens cows up very quickly, but it's not the natural food of cows. They're supposed to eat grass. And because so often they're fed corn, it leads to all kinds of different infections that they wouldn't ordinarily get if they were feeding normally. And so, again, they're pumped full of antibiotics to keep them from getting sick. All right, so that's the life of animals in factory farms. What's an animal's death like? It begins, this is disturbing stuff. I'm not trying to gratuitously shock anybody. I'm just trying to give people a sense of what's happening. If you find this disturbing, please don't watch the movie Dominion, which is the Delforce movie, which is very, very in your face from start to finish. Animals usually are transported from a factory to a slaughterhouse, usually packed very, very tightly together into trucks with no food or water, because why would you feed or water an animal that's about to be slaughtered anyway? Sometimes they're exposed in all kinds of weather temperatures. Quite a large percentage of animals die in transport or are considered too weak for slaughter when they arrive. In other words, they're just incapacitated. In pig farms, they call these downer piles, where you're loading the pigs off a truck and you just throw all the sick ones into a pile to die outside, because they're not even strong enough to be killed inside the slaughterhouse. Slaughtering methods vary hugely depending on the animal, but chickens are usually hung upside down by their feet onto a sort of a conveyor belt and are dragged through a stunning tank that's basically electrified water, which is supposed to stun them, make them unconscious before their heads are cut off. And then they go through a scalding tank, which removes all their feathers. Large mammals, pigs and sheep and goats and cows, are usually shocked or incapacitated with a taser or something like that, before they're slaughtered. But also they're hung up by their hind legs, and then their throats are cut. This is just how it's done. The process of stunning animals before slaughter was actually required by law since 1958. Believe it or not, a Humane Methods of Slaughter Act that was passed in 1958 under Dwight Eisenhower. The aim was to prevent needless suffering by rendering animals insensible to pain before they're killed. I think this is better than nothing, but it's not great. Because the stunning process itself is painful and terrifying and not even effective sometimes. It's a fact that some animals are killed fully conscious. How do you tell whether an animal is truly insensible to pain? There's not much time to find out. So, one of the other things that this woman, Temple Grandin, has thought a lot about, she's done a lot of sort of reform of slaughterhouse techniques because of her understanding of animals, particularly the emotional state of animals, the fear that animals are in when they can see, hear, and smell other animals dying right ahead of them in the line, right? Animals can smell blood. They know exactly what it means. In a lot of ways, needlessly horrifying for them. All of this to say the priority is speed and efficiency because of the massive scale, the massive demand of that these factories have to be putting out all the time. It's huge. So my point is, if efficiency is the only guiding principle, if we think about guiding principles, why we do what we do, if efficiency is the only guiding principle, it is inevitable that animals will be treated not as living things, but as commodities or economic units, right? Or one person has said that animals are treated as meat-producing machines. They're a machine that produces meat. They're not a living thing that can feel or sense anything. So this in turn leads to practices that deny the unique dignity of living things because they're not viewed as living things, they're viewed as an economic unit. So practically speaking, in a factory, there's no meaningful difference between a chicken and a brick or the rock that you can kick down the road. Concluding reflections. I'm sorry, this is a bit of a depressing lecture, I'm just realizing. what are we to make of this? what do we say? What do we do? If we search the pages of the Bible for a sort of a universal command to be vegetarians, we're not going to find it. So the Bible doesn't teach that as some sort of universal. You know, there are times in the Bible that where God seems to favor a vegetarian diet over meat or a simple life over. In the book of Daniel, when Daniel is offered all the fine meat and wines of the house of the king, he says, "No, I'm just going to eat my vegetables," and he ends up being smarter and healthier at the end of this time. Anyway, go read Daniel. Anyway, there's moments where the issue comes up, but there's not any sort of universal teaching about not eating meat in the Bible. And I think the people that try to find it aren't really, in my opinion, aren't reading the Bible well enough or carefully enough. Nowhere does it say or imply that eating a plant-based diet is essential to the Christian life. That may be a big relief to people. I don't know. in the Bible, eating animals is generally permitted by God, but always within the broader ethical framework that God has established. There's a lot of ethical teaching about how to treat animals. even though we're never told you have to stop eating meat. So human beings are not free to define their relationship to animals. That relationship is defined by God. The ethics of treating animals in the Bible assumes that they are capable of experiencing pain, suffering, and fear, as well as contentment and happiness. So this is what we call sentient. If a creature is sentient, capable of experiencing suffering and pleasure. All of the ethical teaching in the Bible assumes that that's the case. If you think of just the particular needs of a cow, for instance, appropriate food, in other words, grass and not corn, water, rest, clean air, space to move, shelter, security, the ability to reproduce and care for its young, these are things that we should provide for farm animals. If the Bible is our ethical guide, particularly this is something I didn't mention earlier, is the ability to reproduce and care for its young. This is something that is horrendous on dairy farms. where female cows are inseminated over and over and over and over and over and over again. They give birth to a calf. It's taken away immediately to get the maximum milk production out of the cow. And then once their milk starts to taper off, they're inseminated. I mean, it's this brutal, unnatural, like no cow is designed to live in this way, right? All for the sake of getting as much milk out of this thing as possible. It's very much treating it as a machine, a milk-producing machine. You know, never allowed to care for their young, right? So, anyway, this is what respecting animal dignity should look like, I think. Again, if we're taking the Bible as our ethical guide, appropriate food, water, rest, security, shelter, all these different things that we can see animals need. I think because standard practice on intensive factory farms is to deny almost all of these things, I think there's very good biblical reasons to not support factory farms in any way. That's not to say that Christians are called to only be vegetarians. I'm not saying that, but I am saying if general ethical teaching in terms of treatment of animals is our guide, the treatment of animals on factory farms is inexcusable, and we shouldn't support it. Now, for some people, I think this means vegetarianism or veganism. I think that there is room for the conscience of individuals to decide which battles they pick. I'm not going to declare from on high what anybody has to do, because if I do, I'd be guilty myself of whatever I said. So I do think that I know many people who are vegetarians, and I respect their reasons for making that choice. I don't think it should be a universal necessarily, but I respect. I believe that some of those reasons are righteous. For others, I think it can mean eating meat only from small farms that treat animals well, right up to the point of death. Free-range chickens, cage-free and free-range. There's all kinds of delineations when you go and buy eggs at the supermarket, but. Free range basically means they are not kept in tiny cages and allowed more room to move. Grass-fed cattle or antibiotic-free food. Now a lot of these come from smaller farms, and because the animals on these farms are raised inefficiently, quote unquote, the meat will be more expensive almost always. Which means that for many people, it means eating less meat. But I think this is fine. We will not starve. In fact, we may very well be healthier, not just because we're eating less meat, but the meat we're eating isn't full of all the chemicals that are often pumped into animals in factory farms. This is a direction that appeals to me personally. Again, I haven't arrived here yet, but this is a direction in which I'm sort of on a journey towards doing more. Supporting smaller farms where you have more of a sense of what's actually happening to the animals. And I think this appeals to me not just in a negative sense because I want to boycott the industrial machine or whatever, but in a positive sense also because these are smaller, kinder, quote-unquote less efficient farms that are really worth supporting because they're doing what they're doing. And it's actually not an easy... not an easy living to make in a world that's flooded with cheap meat from factory farms. So I think if we want to continue eating meat, we should consider trying to actually support farms that are treating animals well as a positive call, not just a negative rejection of other meat. The most sort of full-on radical lifestyle change sometimes are not practical. The all-or-nothing approach often ends with nothing in terms of making real decisions in our lives. I think this has to be practical, has to be doable. I think it's better to make small and meaningful changes that you can stick with than to make drastic changes and then bail on them. So if you come away from the lecture tonight saying, it's veganism or nothing, you know, great, if you want to do that. That often is unsustainable. Very often it's more of a journey for people that ends up being effective. And this is one of the reasons, why the whole veganism or nothing rhetoric I think is unhelpful. Andrew Lindsay, who I've been quoting a lot, he's a committed vegetarian for a lot of these ethical reasons as a Christian, but he's very wise on this point. He's like, nobody should be on a soapbox yelling veganism. That it ends up being totally alienating first and foremost, and everyone comes away feeling condescended to and judged. But also, it's much, much better to encourage people to make changes that they can actually make in terms of starting to think more carefully and more intentionally about what we eat. If you eat meat every day, pick a day of the week not to eat meat. If you already do this, consider reversing it and pick one day of the week when you do eat meat. These are just thoughts, right? These are not prescriptions. But this can help us shift our mindset, I think, so that we don't feel entitled to meat at every meal. I think one of the issues is that we just feel like that's an expectation, right? That mindset should be shifted, I think. Vegetables, fruit, grains, beans, and nuts, is all kinds of amazing things to eat, all of which are gifts from God in a very daily sense. Maybe meat should be thought of as a feast item, right? And there's time for feasting and celebration. It's not that, you know, I think part of it is an issue of the imagination. There's a multitude of options available to people in America. Obviously, there's issues of economics and social class and areas. There's areas where it's very hard to find healthy food to eat. But for those of us who do have the privilege of choice, we're not going to die if we eat less meat. Everyone knows this intellectually, but many of us sort of feel maybe on an emotional level that we might die. You know what I mean. Like we live in our meat consumption will be consigned to just bland, boring, unsatisfying meals. You know, dinner time won't be something to look forward to anymore. Our imagination needs a boost in terms of what actually is available and possible. I've been, blessed to have a good friend, actually a housemate living with us now, who's vegetarian and all kinds of interesting things, to eat that are not meat. So it's been a help to me. But we won't know. Our imaginations will never get this boost unless we actually try something. Last point, and this is way more important than I have time to give it, but I think while the misunderstandings of the image of God and human dominion have been responsible for a lot of untold misery, as Christians, we cannot afford to jettison or even minimize the image of God as a really, really, really important thing, even in this context. It's because of dominion and the image of God, if we rightly understand them, that gives us a foundation for actual responsible care for the world and for the animals that are within our care. The image of God and dominion particularly is all about power rightly exercised. Power that God gives human beings in creation, but power that we are expected to exercise rightly, as in, as stewards, caring for creation in the way that God cares for creation. In his place, in a sense. We are the image of God on this planet, trying to reflect something of who God is to the creation. That's the role of human beings. And so it's actually the image of God and this whole idea of dominion is a really the only place to stand when it comes to how we're supposed to interact with creation. The fact that God creates people as being especially significant and of value does not at all imply that we have the right to abuse the world around us. So, that's where I'm going to end. There's obviously a lot more to say, and there's many, many loose ends. But I'll... Oh, there's some pigs in the field. Okay. If you haven't been here before on a Friday night, we have a time of discussion and questions, and that can go for a while. But if you need to leave, you can feel free to leave. The lecture's over now, but if you want to stay, you can too. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. Really compelling lecture. Just had a couple of questions to kind of clarify the line for the ethics around this. And, you know, totally understand you haven't had a chance to give thought to it. You know, I don't expect you to give an answer on the fly, but
you've
had it. I was kind of curious. So you talked about the killing of animals for the purposes of eating.
Yep.
But I'm wondering, what about killing of, like, pests? How do we think about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'm also wondering, so with the last point that you made about adopting, like, practical changes into your life that are actually doable.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like in a variety of issues, there's kind of this tension between incremental change versus, like, you know, like, not making any concessions on, you know, some sort of ideological point.
Yeah.
And there was this very interesting article that came out a couple years ago, or several years ago. I don't know if it's changed, but the finding was actually water in Manhattan was not kosher because they had microscopic crustaceans inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking about the Genesis 9 passage where it talks about the lifeblood and, like, not eating animals. I don't know if that's if you meant that in, like, a very direct way, or if you meant that in a more general, like, conscientiousness way, but in that case, is it just something that we kind of lament and then hope for change for, or is that something that's just like I have to abstain from tap water until it changes?
Yeah, I think with any kind of practical issue before us, we're always dealing with a fallen situation in which there's no perfect act, right? Everything is going to be some kind of concession to reality. I think in terms of microbes in the water that we drink, there may be all kinds of reasons for within kosher laws for defending that, but I don't think, to me, Genesis 9 is the context of Genesis 9 is so clearly talking about big animals, mammals, that I don't, I would have a hard time applying that text to something like bacteria in the water. I think we have to, because the world has fallen and we are limited, we're making decisions all the time that aren't perfect. But we have to make them. It's a little bit like voting. It's like, I think most, my feeling is that, maybe this really isn't true, but I feel like any thoughtful Christian, whatever they vote, they're going to be conflicted, right? I mean, if they're not conflicted, then they're not thinking hard enough, you know? There's no clean vote. You have to pick whatever issue is most important to you and affects your conscience most. And then if you want to participate at all, you have to vote. And I feel like this, you know, that's analogous to a lot of the decisions we have to make each day. But I feel that way here at Labrie. I do not, and I think when we can afford it and we find things on sale, we try to buy meat that we know was raised ethically. But, you know, the reality is if we're going to serve meat and there's 20 people coming over to lunch, we're just not going to, we can't afford it. We do make decisions about not feeding lots of meat to people. We try to make it, we spread it out, make it last. But there's all kinds of battles to choose in the moment. If we have a very, very rigid, if we approach it from a very rigid standpoint of like personal purity, basically, like I cannot, on principle, support this thing out here. That could be maybe very effective, but it's also a very, very easy way to become self-righteous about it. And it also doesn't necessarily have much to do practically with making a difference and, you know, actually it's more a matter of my own purity. So it's a very difficult thing. I think that we have to just, in everything we do, we're always dependent on God's mercy and His grace, and we're making decisions that are imperfect. But I think when we can, we need to try to act on the biblical teaching around ethics that we can. I think that's maybe a totally unsatisfying answer. What was your first question? Was
killing context besides eating? Like,
oh yeah. To me, okay. So this is a great question. I've thought a bit about this because I have a garden and it's always getting invaded by animals. And until recently, a chicken coop that was always getting invaded by predators. Okay. And part of that's my own lack of good husbandry. I think that there's good ethical grounds to make boundaries. I don't think that I am justified ethically to like go off into the woods and kill every fox that I find. I do think I am justified ethically to do whatever I can to keep a fox from killing my chickens, even if that means like throwing a rock at its head. I feel, you know, because there's boundaries. And the chicken coop is a space that I'm exercising my dominion over in which foxes aren't supposed to be. And it's kind of interesting. There's lots of language in the Old Testament about boundaries being transgressed, you know, like about, you know, one of the signs of God's judgment on people is if the wild animals like move into your house. Or the jackals hang out in your, you know, in your courtyard, or whatever. That's a sign that like catastrophe has overtaken you, and now the owls roost in your, you know, in the, whatever, the rafters of your house. So that there's this image of like that's a sign that things aren't how they're supposed to be. And that is not a green light to go owl hunting, but it is a sense in which we actually human beings actually do have. A legitimate space on Earth, and so I think there's a. I think you know, I believe there's such a thing as a varmint. You know, a woodchuck that's just enjoying itself out in the field isn't a varmint, but a woodchuck that's in my garden is a varmint. So anyway, that's otherwise. I mean, and very practically speaking, otherwise there's no point in having a garden. You know, unless you're willing to do something about the woodchucks, and that's. There's all kinds of humane things one could do. Just build a better fence. I think even then we have to be careful. But this, the guy Andrew Lindsay, what was it? Some article I read recently talking about the humane treatment of animals law passed in England about not ever being able to disturb the roosting place of bats. Even if they're like in your house, you're legally prohibited from like ridding your house of bats. Basically, maybe it's not in your actual living room, but in your attic or in your barn, all the places where you might not want bats. There's legal protections for them, and that's an interesting one to me because part of me thinks like, okay, bats are good for bats are actually great. You know, they eat insects and they're you know. There's a stigma against bats, people that's probably unwarranted. But at the same time, if there's like 1,000 bats roosting in my attic, shouldn't I be able to do something about it? Anyway, that was a tricky one. I was like, I don't know about that one. Anyway, Richard, yeah.
There's a thousand questions that we could discuss here. There are a couple of things that you could have said about the issue from Genesis 9
yep.
about the lifeblood.
Yep.
And, of course, that comes way before the Levitical law.
Sure.
That came to Moses later. But in Leviticus, in chapter 21,
mm-hmm.
there is a whole discussion of the life of the creature is in its blood,
yep.
and it is the blood that makes the atonement for the sin.
Yep.
And then we are commanded, don't eat the creature's flesh that still has the blood in it. So
yep.
there is a necessity for letting the blood come out before this becomes lawful food for you.
Yep.
And interestingly enough, way, way long time later, at the Council of Jerusalem, when Paul comes back from his missionary journey,
yep.
that was the one item of food consumption that they laid upon the Gentiles.
Yep.
That the Gentiles who became Christians could not eat flesh that had blood in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't pretend to know everything about this, but mm-hmm. there's plainly something very important about the blood and the circulation of blood
mm-hmm.
and the manifestation of life, which is in the dynamic circulation of the blood, which occurs, and that's going on, and then that ceases. The blood itself is the atonement.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Jesus shed his blood for
yep.
us
yep.
as an atonement.
Yep.
And... Well, okay, that's another whole lecture. But we should not overlook all those points.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, the Genesis 9 is sort of this first reference to the shedding of blood of an animal, of being, and you're right, I think it is developed much, much more, both in the practice, but also in a sense in the symbolism in within the sacrificial system. The significance of blood being shed for sin is that the blood is the life of the animal, and the animal is given its life, its blood. It's all very. I don't know a whole lot about that, but I've heard a lot of some very convincing arguments about the Genesis 9 passage, which are not claiming so much this in a symbolic sense that it's not good for you to eat animals with blood in it still, but much more the very kind of nasty practical sense that the animal needs to be dead, people.
There's a presumption against swallowing live goldfish in that.
Certainly. Yeah, Jack.
So I wanted to build off of that.
Yeah.
So... when he says, like, don't eat the blood, for the life is in the blood, I think that's brought full circle, like you said, when Jesus died, because so he voluntarily shed his blood, which didn't just mean his physical blood, but his life. He gave his inner life for you, and it kind of takes the death of Jesus beyond a sacrifice and into, like, he gave, like, so if you understand, you have a deeper life, kind of like a life force, life blood, and that might have had a double meaning of life. Blood, and that doesn't just mean blood, but mm-hmm. Jesus gave that innermost part of himself for you
mm-hmm.
by dying on the cross, and it just takes a lot deeper. Mm-hmm. And so I guess also I stopped eating beef because it was unhealthy, but then I also read that passage. I was like, well, don't eat the blood, for the life is in the blood, and like red meat is blood. I mean, you're mm-hmm. eating meat, it tastes good because of the blood. And then it's convenient that that's also, like, the least healthy, hardest to digest meat.
Hmm.
And it's just kind of, I don't know. Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't hear that as a forbidding red meat as much
no,
as...
No, I know.
Yeah. even in factory farms, the blood is drained out of animals. Not for righteous reasons, maybe, but yeah. Yeah, you're right, though, that this idea of the blood of Jesus is very much... it's more than just the literal fluid in his body. It's that plus everything that symbolizes in that context, which is his very life. It's very, yeah. Is there another question here? Yeah, Kristen.
Yeah, I'm wondering if in your research, I heard this snippet, so I haven't listened to this guy talk, but it's going to be in an upcoming podcast. but he was addressing the fact that there is so much about this industry, which presumably came out of the fact that we don't want people starving, mm-hmm. right? that injures our environment and is ethically questionable and all that sort of thing. And his solution is we should be engineering food. In other words, now that we have the capability to, basically probably have the capability to, like, 3D print our food, for example.
Well done.
So that brings up questions in my mind about, you know, creation is still going to keep appropriating, do you know what I mean? And it's like, okay, so let's just say that this particular industry goes bust because we find another way of mass producing food in a less wasteful or less cruel or less environmentally damaging way. I just thought it was a fascinated by this. Like, what is the next iteration of solving our food problem for this population that grows? You know, our world population just keeps growing. If you touched on any of that when you were researching,
I mean only very generally, and it's just I'll just voice some loud opinions that aren't really backed up by anything. But I have a big problem with the general approach that we have this big problem, which is essentially is multiple layers of technological dysfunction, and what are we going to do to solve it? Another layer of technology. some hugely innovative new way to solve the hunger crisis in the world. I mean, it's similar to, so like the whole thing with hives, beehives collapsing. There's a massive problem around, the world with beehives collapsing. Everyone pretty much knows it's on some level connected to pesticide use. There's also mites and various things that destroy hives, but it's basically a hive collapses in the space of a year and the whole thing is dead and nobody, you know, what do? You just have to start over. The prospect of that happening on a wide, on a broad scale is horrifying because of what bees do. I mean, bees are the primary pollinators for all of agriculture. And so, I've heard like discussions about what should we do? We have to somehow engineer, like, some kind of, literally, like, micro drones. This is a serious conversation. Rather than step back and question the assumptions that are the root of the problem, which are just dousing everything in pesticides. No. We can't question that. We're so smart. We need to invent something even more technological to fix it. There's not a lot of encouragement, historically speaking, to believe that that will actually help. That'll be one more problem to unravel, and part of that is beef in this country. This may be totally unrealistic, ridiculously unrealistic, because it has to do with a whole cultural change. You know, people. We don't actually need as much meat. To say that the world will starve if we don't keep on producing this amount of meat is a falsehood, I think. By producing less meat, we would have less of an environmental impact. If you think of the even...
You can do it with grain, too.
Yeah, it's yeah,
not
yeah.
Like we're not
or mon- just in general, like a monoculture, like let's pour all of our money into one thing. I mean, the movie Food Inc. is hugely disturbing, but it talks about because of the huge demand for beef, the government subsidizes corn farmers to grow nothing but corn and get paid more than they could possibly get paid normally because it's subsidized in order to feed cows, a food that they shouldn't be eating in the first place. In order to keep having, corn is hugely degrading. I mean, in terms of the amount of nutrients it uses up in the soil and water it absorbs. And so it's a huge impact grain to grow. But the question of, wait a second, should we maybe, and then the solution to that, the fact that all the soil is depleted when we're growing corn, is to produce more and more high-tech fertilizers, which drain, it's this level upon level of technological solutions rather than questioning the actual root of this problem, which is cows are supposed to eat grass, and Anyway, and maybe we just need to be eating. There's all kinds of interesting statistics about like how much water does it take to produce 1 pound of beef in terms of environmental impact. And, I don't even have the statistics in front of me, but it's like ridiculous. Yeah, in terms of what the hidden cost. What's that?
It's like 16 gallons of water. It's a lot of
water to produce 1 pound of beef. Yeah.
And then you compare it to like chicken and pork and poultry versus like agricultural.
Yeah. That's what people call the hidden cost. We don't see that cost because corn is subsidized to feed cows to allow us to have cheap meat and everything is so efficient. But like you think about the hidden cost environmentally of a single pound of meat, it gives you a better vision of what's actually going on. Yeah.
I'm just going to jump in and
correct
that.
Please.
I knew that was really off, so I Googled it.
Okay.
It's 1,799 gallons of water for 1 pound of beef.
What? Say it again.
1,799 gallons of water for 1 pound of beef. 576 gallons of water for a pound of pork.
Right.
Yeah.
So the amount of water a cow or a pig has to consume throughout its life in order to come to slaughter factors, you know.
As well as the food that.
As well as the food that's grown to feed. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Richard.
Of course, we exist in a historical context.
Yeah.
And we didn't get to this point from, we talked about the day of Noah stepping off the ark. There's a little bit of history between now and now.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, fine.
And we must recognize some things about nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
One of those is that humans do need some source of protein.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And a fairly concentrated protein in their diet.
Yep.
In order for them to live well.
Yep.
Are you aware of a disease called kwashiorkor?
No, I'm not.
There is a disease called kwashiorkor, which is fairly common in some parts of Asia, where people do not, in fact, get enough protein.
Yeah.
And, well, some parts of Africa as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they get very bad physical symptoms, including painfully distended bellies.
Mm.
From a lack of protein in their diet.
Yeah.
And they are eating things like cassava root and things that are high carbohydrate.
Starch, yeah.
Very starchy vegetables of various kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And very little protein.
Mm-hmm.
And a protein deficiency disease is very debilitating, and over time people die from this.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is a human requirement. We must have some protein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we now have modern nutritional science.
Yeah.
And so we know which amino acids we need. We know lots of things about the food chain,
mm-hmm.
which 100 years ago were entirely unknown.
Sure.
And so today, you can be a nutritional scientist and you say, okay, if you eat vegetable A plus vegetable B plus vegetable C, okay, that will
makes a complete protein or whatever, yes. Yeah.
But 100 years ago, that was unknown.
Yeah.
And so basically you hedged your bets 100 years ago by eating lots of kinds of stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, and one of those lots of kinds of stuff that people have traditionally eaten has in fact been protein from animal sources.
Sure. Yep.
So we have a technological ability to live and not get kwashiorkor today,
mm-hmm.
which 100 years ago it was hit or miss, would you
sure.
get it or not?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, one of the reasons that we like the taste of meat is that our bodies know that we need protein.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so these are factors that must go into this discussion of what we as a society should do about meat.
Totally. I wouldn't contest anything you said. I mean, I totally agree with everything you just said. We do know a lot more about nutrition than people did 100, 200 years ago. To eat meat was if you could get it, was a reliable source of protein. You're taking on the protein of another animal. Today, though, given the knowledge we do have and the availability of food we do have, it is quite possible to get the protein you need if you take the trouble to figure out how to do it without eating meat.
I mean, in terms of
yeah, okay, yeah. You're right. But there's also a great cultural
sure
thing,
yeah
okay
yeah
and so our culture regards the eating of meat in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And who is human and is not influenced by a culture of some kind, right?
Yeah.
So, all right. So, you know, there are ways to influence cultures, sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I believe what you're trying to do is point out how people are trying to influence a culture.
Mm-hmm.
but, you know, let's not take a big guilt trip out of this either.
No, and that's not my intention. If this is coming across like a big guilt trip, I'm really sorry. That's not my intention at all.
Vegans are.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's and I'm not trying to put the heavies on people. Really, I mean, really, what I'm trying to do is be like, this is what's going on. A little bit of exposure to what's actually happening. It's not so much I'm trying to make you all feel guilty as much as it is, hey, if we enjoy eating meat all the time, we might as well know where it came from. And if we're uncomfortable with what had to happen for us to get it, and we would never do it ourselves to an animal, why should I pay someone else to do it? Yeah.
There's a guy in our small group who works, he's kind of a guru of 3D printing in the world.
Yeah.
And the company he worked for in the past doesn't work there now, mm-hmm. developed a 3D printer that actually prints meat. And there's companies that are basically growing the meat in tanks, so they're not coming from animals, they're just using cell cultures. And so they're growing fat, and they're growing meat, and then they can make any percentage of fat in meat. So they're producing like 90% steak that's
10%
fat.
So it gets extruded out of some sort of nozzle?
Yeah. And they're actually printing meat. And you can get the steak marbleized exactly how you want it. So no animals are killed in the making of this beef.
The cells grown.
I have no comment. I don't know.
No pesticides, no farms.
Wow. Part of me says, try a vegetable. I mean, what? I mean, it's impressive. Anyway, that's crazy. I need to go look that up.
Yeah. I have a good... my name's Ken. I've been a meat eater for 50 years.
Carnivore!
I have a good friend. He's a scientist. He works for NOAA down in Woods Hole, and he's an avid fisherman and occasional hunter, duck hunter, not too often, but he's really good. He's a bachelor, and he fishes all the time.
Is that why he's a bachelor?
Dang
it. Okay.
But, you know, as you have your garden and chickens and things like that, he has a garden, he has any chickens, but, you know, he fishes and he eats all that he catches. He does buy meat from the market and tries to buy high quality meats. Mm-hmm. But he said to me like a long time ago that he really felt that there is a separation. I think you've just touched upon it. You've touched upon it in other parts of your lecture, that there is a real separation from us and our food and where it comes from.
Yeah.
And he said that that's really missing. And I mean, lots of people have gardens, and you know, lots of people that have chickens too. But fewer people fish and eat what they, and then very few people grow any kind of cattle or pork or anything like that.
Yeah.
But he said that relationship between fishing and hunting, that it's a missing thing that links us with nature and with God. And I think of other cultures or other religions that will pray when they they harvest an animal and they'll thank a god or gods for it. That type of interaction with nature, as you said, we're part of nature and we're also like above it, sort of too, at the same time. But so anyway, it was neat. It's neat to think about.
Yeah.
But one of the things that worries me a little bit, and I always have a difficult time with this for many years, in that the Genesis passage, that we are to go forth and multiply. I worry about that commandment because I think so much of our problem in this world is population.
Yep.
And, when we have these meat factories and things like that, which I agree with you, probably aren't necessary as much as we have to have them. But I don't know, that's like a... I worry about our world, our natural world, as our population increases, and yet we're told to do that. I don't know.
Yeah. And God doesn't say in Genesis, and here's when you stop, when the population reaches this level. And that's a hard thing. I mean, the population, one of the reasons why the population is increasing so much is because of modern medicine. Fewer people are dying of things that, and so that it's just that's a huge issue that I don't know how to address it. I do want to say something about your first comment, which is, I think, part of the part of the reason why a lot of the things that can happen that do in factory farms is because we are so separated from the source of our food. Chicken is something that's wrapped in plastic that I get at the grocery. I'm sure there's lots of young kids that don't even think of it. Doesn't even occur to them that it used to be a living animal. I mean, and to me, I haven't really done much hunting, but I've fished quite a lot and have friends who hunt, and they've described a similar thing where you actually are as aware as you could ever be where your food is coming from. You know exactly how it died. You know exactly and there's a sense of connection to what we're putting in our bodies and respect, yeah, given the work that it takes. But I do think that the separation of ourselves from food is a big problem. I mean, I think I wouldn't ever make this a law, you know. But to me, I think if you eat chicken at some point or other, you should slaughter a chicken. You shouldn't kill every chicken that you eat. That's impractical. But at some point or other, you should experience what it's like for a living thing to turn into meat.
Well,
and to actually see it.
Honestly, my dad grew up in Roxbury,
yeah.
And there were 9 kids in the family, and
yeah.
So they're in the city, but they had chickens and they had a garden.
Yeah,
always.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's how you fed a family.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's how you had eggs.
Yeah.
Cold water flat.
Allison is a very eager hand.
Well, I think maybe the piece that we are missing, and I don't mean this as a critique exactly, but people are required to work in those places.
Yeah, no, no,
humans,
yeah.
And those are places where vulnerable people are working.
Mm-hmm.
Those are places where illegal immigrants are mm-hmm. often trafficked.
Yep.
Those are places where there's an article in the New Yorker in May 2017.